Hello and welcome to the latest podcast from the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, supporting new approaches to improve health and tackle inequality. This podcast is the first of three FINS webinars focused on the impact of, the context to, and the emergence from the COVID-19 pandemic. FINS is the Public Health Information Network for Scotland, and the webinar was organised by the Glasgow Centre for Population Health and Public Health Scotland as part of the ScotFO collaboration. This podcast was recorded live via Zoom on Thursday the 3rd of September 2020 and includes a talk by Margaret Douglas of the University of Edinburgh on multiple pathways, mitigating the wider impacts of COVID-19 response, and Anoush Kapilashrami of the University of Essex on moving beyond silos, using an intersectionality lens to understand the multidimensional crisis of COVID-19.
So it's a real pleasure to be hosting this first seminar of the FINS 2020 webinar series. My name's Vital Katkredi. I'm an academic at the University of Glasgow. And this is the first of three webinars that will be happening over the next few weeks. So for those of you who don't know, FINS is the Public Health Information Network for Scotland, and these seminars have been going for 20 years, but this is the first virtual seminar series. They're organised by the Glasgow Centre for Population Health and Public Health Scotland as part of the Scottish Public Health Observatory collaboration. So this particular seminar series will be focused on understanding the impact of COVID-19, but all three linked online webinars are focused on the impacts of and the context to an emergence from the COVID-19 pandemic. As some of you may have noticed in the chat, we're encouraging people to tweet about the webinar, and if you do, please use the hashtag FINS2020, so that's hashtag capitals PHINS 2020. The webinar is being recorded, so it will be available after the event, along with a copy of the presentation slides on the ScotFO website. So when these are available, the links will be emailed to you, so you can, I'm sure, enjoy them again or share them with colleagues. So our first speaker today is Dr. Margaret Douglas. She's co-director of the Masters of Public Health Programme in Edinburgh University and an honorary consultant in public health within Public Health Scotland, and chairs the Scottish Health and Inequalities Impact Assessment Network. It's a real pleasure to introduce Margaret today, who has been an important personal mentor for my career, and has been a real advocate for public health within Scotland more generally. So without further ado, I will hand over to Margaret to give her presentation, which we're very much looking forward to.
So thank you very much indeed for that introduction, Vital, and thank you very much indeed to the organisers for inviting me to speak today. It is a real pleasure to be here. The theme of this series of webinars, of course, is the current COVID-19 pandemic, and I'm going to talk about the range of health impacts that we are seeing as a result of the pandemic. I'm going to talk about the range of pathways by which the pandemic is affecting health, how they interact with inequalities, comment on some of the measures needed to mitigate these impacts, and finally say a few words about what I think this all means should be priorities for future policy. Of course, the most obvious impact of the pandemic has been the direct mortality and morbidity caused by COVID-19 disease. To date, according to death certificate data, over 4,000 people in Scotland have died earlier than they otherwise would have as a result of COVID-19. And this slide shows the wave of deaths in hospitals and care homes predominantly from death certificate data between the beginning of March and the end of June. But the impacts go way beyond these direct deaths from COVID-19. Back in March, before the lockdown was announced, a few of us were concerned that the physical distancing measures that were being proposed may themselves affect health. And so we carried out a very rapid health impact assessment to try to understand what these impacts might be. It was a very rapid assessment. The initial assessment was done in just a week. And in that timescale, we couldn't include any stakeholder involvement in this assessment, but we did use a structured approach to identify populations and impacts. And we reviewed data on evidence of the relevance of these impacts for health and the numbers of people who were likely to be at highest risk. And I'd like to acknowledge my colleagues who took part in this assessment, who are listed on the slide. The health impact assessment was subsequently published in the BMJ, who produced this infographic, which summarises the pathways. And what it shows on the left-hand side is the purple pathway from COVID-19 infection causing direct morbidity and mortality. But along the top, we also considered the physical distancing measures, home isolation, restriction in non-essential sectors, transport restrictions and educational closure. And you could see on this diagram that there are a number of different interlinked pathways by which these ultimately have impacts on health. And this slide just summarises the range of impacts that we identified. And you can see that we identified several different pathways by which the physical distancing measures were likely to impact on health, including economic, social factors, disruption to services, and even impacts on the physical environment. And I'm going to talk through several of these in the next few slides. So one of our biggest concerns was the economic effects, particularly on vulnerable people. Of course, we know that the pandemic has had a very big effect on the economy, but it's how this affects people that matters for health. Many people have lost income or been unable to work during the lockdown period, and there's also a risk of longer term unemployment. And this has particularly affected people who are already at risk, people who are in low paid work, precarious employment in the gig economy, and people who are in sectors that are unable to work from home. This graph shows the claimant count, which includes people on universal credit who are required to seek work, and also people on job seekers allowance. And you can see that this number has doubled since March and is likely to increase further as the furlough period comes to an end. And this all matters for health because there is such a strong association between income and health, particularly for people who are already on low incomes and may be pushed into food insecurity, which we have been seeing during the pandemic, fuel poverty, even potentially homelessness, if people lose their rents when rent eviction and protection ends. And in addition, unemployment has a very large effect on health. A meta-analysis found that among people who become unemployed and do not regain employment, there's a 76% increase in all-cause mortality in the first 10 years. Vital, who's chairing today's session, is co-leading a social and system recovery group that's one of the groups that was set up to follow up the health impact assessment. And that group has been modelling the impact of these changes in income and employment on health and produced the paper that's shown on the slide on protecting the health of the working age population and families as lockdown reduces. And this paper contains a series of very specific recommendations which focus on preventing poverty, supporting fair employment through an inclusive labour market strategy, and in the longer term, creating an inclusive economy, which provides equal access to opportunities and equitable distribution of the benefits of the economy. So a second area we identified in the HIA was impacts on mental health through social isolation of people staying at home alone, and also the widespread fear and anxiety that the pandemic was causing in the population. We know that social isolation has very negative effects on health and is associated with increased mortality. And a large proportion, about a third of the Scottish population, lives alone and would be particularly at risk. Throughout the pandemic, there have been several surveys running to try to track people's mental health, and these have shown high levels of mental health symptoms. The figures on the slide are from a survey by the Mental Health Foundation, and you can see that it did find high levels of mental distress, particularly in young adults. And the mental health problems have been differentially distributed. Young adults seem to have borne the brunt, particularly of the mental health impacts during the pandemic. People with pre-existing mental health problems are also at risk, as are people in poverty, which, as we've just heard, has been exacerbated. Mitigation of these impacts has included things like the campaign that's shown on the slide, the Clear Your Head campaign, but I think probably more important is providing practical and social support for people who are isolating and ensuring that communications about the pandemic are clear and consistent and give a good rationale for the restrictions that people are asked to abide by. So as well as being concerned about people who were socially isolated, we were also concerned about the impact on families, and in particular, the risk to people who would be isolated with abusers in conditions of stress. You can see in the slide that there are a large number of domestic abuse incidents every year in Scotland, and there are 2,500 children who are on the Child Protection Register, and these people would be at higher risk of abuse when they were isolated during the pandemic. The report shown on the slide is from Women's Aid, and it found that domestic abuse did worsen during the pandemic and access to escape and support networks was restricted. And I think what this really demonstrates is the importance of maintaining and enhancing support for vulnerable people during the lockdown period and beyond. So another impact on children that we were concerned about was disruption to schooling, which would affect not only formal educational learning, but also the informal social and other support that school brings. Education is a key determinant of health, and educational inequalities are one of the things that underpins health inequalities. This slide is from a UK-wide survey of parents who were asked about the resources their schools provided during the closures. And you can see on the slide that private schools, which are shown in the yellow bands on the slide, were much more likely to provide access to online resources than state schools. But even among the state schools in more affluent areas were more likely to provide online resources than those in poorer areas. This, of course, partly reflects differences in children's access to technology to be able to make use of these resources, but also the other tasks that teaching staff and other staff in schools took on to try to maintain support for vulnerable children during this time. The UN has described the impact of the pandemic on education as a generational catastrophe. And in Scotland, I think school closures are very likely to have increased educational inequalities. There were impacts on other essential services during the lockdown period, including healthcare. The NHS coped very well with the wave of COVID-19 cases, but one of the results of that has been a fall in people able to access other forms of healthcare. This shows just one example, which is hospital admissions for all causes, both emergency and elective. And you can see that the blue line is 2020 and the orange line is previous years. And you can see that there was a very steep fall in the middle of March, and that hospital admissions have still not risen to the level that they were at this time last year. And people who have suffered delayed care are likely to have had avoidable morbidity and mortality as a result. So, many different kinds of impacts. And another area that we identified in the health impact assessment was the impact on transport. During lockdown, the reduction in commuting led to a steep fall in journeys, particularly by car and public transport. And we would expect to see benefits to health from the resulting fall in air pollution and the other adverse effects of motor traffic. There were also increases in walking and cycling during lockdown, probably mainly for leisure and encouraged by the good weather. However, as restrictions have eased, we've seen that car travel has increased, while public transport and other modes have not. This graph only shows journeys between March and June, and you can see that car travel was already creeping back up. And more recent data that are now available from the end of August show that car journeys are only 10% lower than they were this time last year, while public transport journeys remain very low, and walking journeys are now also lower than last year. Transport Scotland has commissioned regular phone surveys, which show that almost half of people intend to avoid public transport and drive instead. And this is a real concern, as it suggests that as more and more people return to the workplace, car travel and traffic are likely to increase further, with negative impacts for air quality, physical activity, injuries and severance. I am chairing a social and system recovery group that's looking at transport, one of the other groups set up to follow up the health impact assessment to try and understand these trends and try to inform policy responses to mitigate these impacts. The slide shows a draft report, which we have already shared with the partners who are involved in this work, and we will have further publications very soon. So the pandemic highlighted the importance of local environments, particularly green spaces for health during the period that people were only allowed out for a short period every day. One of my students, Yasmin Beniles, has completed a qualitative study of the perspectives of parents of young children on green space use during the pandemic. And these are some quotes from her study, which show how important access to local green spaces have been to parents, both to parents themselves who have been trying to work at home with children in the house, and to the children themselves who have needed to get out of the house, really just to burn up some energy and get some physical activity. And the quotes demonstrate how important it has been to parents to have locally available green space more or less on their doorstep. And this, of course, is an important inequalities issue. It's important for people to have high quality local green spaces as a resource, particularly people who are in small living spaces or who do not have their own gardens. Surveys have shown that although some people have made more use of green space during the pandemic, older people and people of lower socioeconomic status have made less use of green space and have not been able to benefit from the health advantages that access to green space affords. Green Space Scotland has produced the guidance that's shown on this slide, which is on managing Scotland's parks and green spaces during the COVID-19 pandemic. And this guidance seeks to balance the support for people to gain the health benefits of their local parks and green spaces with the need for infection control. As part of the development of this guidance, a group of us carried out a rapid scoping exercise, which is the purple document shown here, to try to ensure that it considered the needs of all population groups and the wider benefits of green space access. The community and voluntary sector has been absolutely essential in being able to respond very flexibly to mitigate some of the issues that the pandemic has raised. The slide has some findings from a UK-wide survey that found that most people are confident their local community would support them if they needed it, rising to 71% in over 70s who of course have been most likely to need support. It also found that more than half of adults have themselves checked in on their neighbours in the past week. As well as this level of informal support, community organisations have adapted and set up locally appropriate responses. And the document on the slide is a series of case studies showing how local health groups have responded during the pandemic. This has been a really important part of the mitigation measures put in place in Scotland and is likely to continue to be needed. I'd like to return very briefly to the direct impacts of COVID. Initially, in the early stages of the pandemic, there was a suggestion that everybody was at risk and the pandemic might turn out to be a leveller. But of course, the opposite has happened. This shows the rate of deaths with people with confirmed COVID-19 by deprivation, and shows that people in the most deprived areas have been much more likely to die than those in more affluent areas, with the same gradient that we see for most conditions. And this has reflected an increased risk of transmission, as they're more likely to be in frontline employment or overcrowded housing, increased risk of serious disease because of higher levels of pre-existing morbidity, potentially communication barriers that may reduce people's ability to protect themselves and seek healthcare. But underlying all of these is the impact of poverty. And so the COVID-19 pandemic has both reinforced existing inequalities and probably established new ones. And we really need to understand the direct and indirect effects of COVID in the context of social determinants of health that were already there and have been further impacted through the pathways that I have just talked about. Claire Bamborough and colleagues published a paper on inequalities in COVID that describes it as a syndemic. A syndemic is a set of closely intertwined, mutually enhancing health problems that significantly affect overall health status in a population within the context of a perpetuating configuration of noxious social conditions. And if we want to address the impacts and determinants of the effects of the pandemic, we really need to engage with these wider social conditions as well as reducing transmission. I think in public health, we've tended to consider the pandemic as mainly a health protection issue to be addressed through health infection control measures. And of course, these are very important. But the pandemic, I think, really demands a response that includes all the domains of public health practice. The NHS is now facing huge challenges, as is the social care sector. And there have also been new ways of working developed that need to be evaluated. And I think this needs a healthcare public health response. And the huge economic, social and environmental changes that I've just been talking about need a health improvement response. And we need our health intelligence to be able to support all of these domains of public health practice. Mitigating all of the impacts that I've talked about needs partnership, and I've mentioned quite a few specific mitigation measures for some of the impacts, but these have been part of a whole programme of work led within Public Health Scotland. This started at the end of March using the health impact assessment as a framework, and a series of social mitigation groups were established, which subsequently have been linked to the public health priorities and form part of the social and system recovery programme. These have very much used a health in all policies approach based on sectoral issues to understand trends and work with partners in these sectors to influence policy. And I've mentioned quite a few of the outputs already throughout this presentation, and the slide shows several other examples, which range from things like carrying out a survey of children's health, to input to various Scottish Government and other guidance, to briefings with policy recommendations, to the scoping exercises that we have done on the green space guidance and on public places guidance. And I think these scoping exercises are a very pragmatic, rapid way to highlight broad health and inequalities issues in a situation when we're needing to develop policy very rapidly. I'm personally on two of the social mitigation groups, and it has been a real privilege to be part of them, working together with partners to get to grips with the health issues and feed into policy. And I really hope Public Health Scotland continues to work in this way. So finally, future policy will affect all of our health even more profoundly. There have been so many documents setting out recommendations for building back better that it's quite hard to keep track of them. But I thought I would just finish this presentation with my tuppence worth, based on the ways that the pandemic has affected health and the need to engage with the social determinants that have underpinned its effects. So my suggestion is that the aims of public policy should relate to these three priorities: to improve health and well-being, to reduce the social and economic inequalities that underpin health inequalities, and to protect the environment that we all depend on. I think all public policy should recognise these as priorities. All public policy should be assessed against these three priorities, and we shouldn't support any policies that act against them. So thank you very much indeed for listening. This is my email address if you would like to get in touch with me, and this is the web address for the Scottish Health and Inequalities Impact Assessment Network, where you can find several health impact assessment documents, including the purple documents that I've shown on the slides today. Thank you very much.
That was really excellent. Thanks, Margaret, for a very comprehensive picture of how the pandemic is affecting the broader social determinants. So I'm delighted now to introduce our second speaker, who is Professor Anoush Kapilaswamy, and she is an interdisciplinary social scientist trained in sociology and public health, and is Professor in Global Health Policy and Equity in the in the School of Health and Social Care at the University of Essex. So I'll hand over to Anoush.
So thank you. I mean, I think my job's been made very easy by Margaret, who has really laid a very comprehensive overview of the wider impacts of COVID-19. What I am going to focus on more is really looking at in building back better in developing the recovery plans for countries. Why is it important to embrace an intersectionality lens to understand this multidimensional crisis and tackle it in more effective ways? I will be speaking from a fairly global perspective, drawing on examples from the UK, but also internationally. Just to begin with, I'm going to very briefly introduce the crisis that we are facing today, which Margaret has already alluded to several of the aspects, and talk about the ways in which the risks and burden are distributed in the population, and in essence making a case for intersectionality. Very briefly introduce what intersectionality is and why does it concern us all and why it is important to incorporate it in our analysis. And finally end with a little case vignette of looking at the case of NHS and the healthcare and social care workers' vulnerability in this crisis. So just to begin with, we know that COVID-19 and the pandemic that we are experiencing today at an unprecedented scale is not simply a public health crisis. Margaret has really very comprehensively presented the different public health related impacts and some of the wider impacts as well. And how the pandemic is also impacting on different spheres of our lives. Economic facet of this pandemic is becoming more and more prominent in public policy today. The world is at the brink of the worst recession, and some have argued the worst recession since Great Depression, decline in GDPs and lockdown of economies have placed a great burden on governments, especially those that are already in huge debt, and on governments that are whose economies are relying heavily on certain sectors like aviation, tourism, and non-food retail. At the same time, as Margaret also alluded, what is most significant economic impact is experienced at the household level and how household poverty levels have grown with loss of livelihoods and incomes. And at the same time, this political, the economic crisis has also exposed the political and governance crisis that we are witnessing today. And political landscape world over is now rife with territorialism, nationalism, the most recent case being the nationalism that we're experiencing in the context of vaccine, rather than having a fairly multi-sectoral approach, a multilateral approach to it. But also we find a huge increase in false claims, lack of transparency in sharing evidence, and scapegoating with the most recent scandal around the axing public health, England is a classic example of that. We also find in the political landscape a departure from standard practice and guidelines world over, and an emergence of very diverse kinds of organizations which are gaining legitimacy in the responses. Specifically in particular contexts of faith-based and religious institutions, which are also releasing their own cure and treatment to COVID. And I can get into more details and examples later on. The third aspect that I find most reeling is, of course, the societal impact of the crisis and the impact of the pandemic in workplace settings. COVID-19 has really changed the ways in which people are interacting and also transformed workspaces, has resulted in increase in family violence, and also in long-lasting impact, which we will be seeing as a result of growing fears, anxieties, and erosion of trust in both decision makers, but also at a societal level. Now, the main point I want to draw your attention to is that while these transitions and transformations concern us all, and to that extent, we are all in this together, yet it is clear that COVID-19 is not the great equalizer it was presented as. COVID-19 at once has shed light on the entrenched inequalities, social inequalities that exist in the society. And at the same time, amplified many of these inequalities along various dimensions, both raised in the previous talk, but also ones that I'm going to focus on. Just to take, for example, I mean, some of the early evidence that on COVID indicated that males, older people, and those with underlying conditions are at great risk of severe illness and death. Now, accounting for sex, age, and health comorbidities is crucial, but it clearly does not capture the disparities in distribution of these risk factors. So for instance, further evidence has revealed that risks of cardiovascular disease and diabetes are heightened for ethnic minorities in high-income countries, as well as for indigenous populations living in remote and deprived and impoverished locations. And where data on race and ethnicity is emerging and available, we see alarming rates of infection and death being reported among the Black and Asian minority ethnic populations in the UK and in African American and Caribbean population in underserved communities in the US. We also see the specific risks, including lack of basic amenities, such as housing, healthcare, and culturally and linguistically accessible information on COVID-19, placing other groups such as low-income migrant workers as well as refugees at a greater danger of infection and death. Similarly, I mean, while while we've seen the distribution of risks as being unequal, we also see the impact of the containment measures in the community as bearing a differential burden on the population. And what the pandemic has also revealed is the futility of the standard social and universal messaging and so around social distancing and isolation measures. We find homeless persons, those living in slums, migrants, and refugees residing in camps and detention centers are worse off, particularly because of the cramped conditions of work and living, access to poor water and sanitation facilities necessary to maintain hygiene or practice physical distancing, almost impossible. This was really exemplified by the sudden lockdown measures that were introduced in countries in South Asia, which led to a loss of livelihood for migrant workers who are concentrated in the informal economy there. And also eviction by landlords from the rooming houses that they inhabited resulted in them being stranded in cities, the closure of interstate borders within these countries led them to traveling long distances by foot or in cramped transport situations back to their villages. And we've seen that these have also led to concentrated epidemics in certain factories and certain communities. Now, let us also look at the gendered impact of lockdown measures. The early phase of the pandemic has really introduced a lot of emphasis and focus on the gendered impacts, where one set of evidence was revealing how men are at increased likelihood of infection and more susceptible to infections. And other body of evidence was talking about the other burden of other gendered ways in which pandemic impact can be felt. For example, the care burden of pandemic being mostly on women. Similarly, as Margaret was referring to instances of family violence and increased risk of gender-based violence among women and children. But let us look at whether these experiences and the burden can be understood in a very homogenized way. We see that care burden is mostly on women, but again, not evenly shared. Single mothers, those on precarious employment without social security, women in frontline caring, domestic and health work are worse off and have far limited resources. Margaret did allude to the point regarding the education, the inequalities experienced in the educational setting. Similarly, the huge digital divide that we are experiencing today and the resources that the families and women, particularly within families, have access to is far limited as compared to those in more affluent areas or less deprived areas. So we know that these burdens are unequally distributed. The impact is unequal. And as a result, silo thinking is insufficient. Silo thinking along these unidimensional axes of vulnerabilities is insufficient in tackling this crisis that we're dealing with today. So intersectionality moves beyond this such siloed approach and offers a platform to radically rethink COVID-19 for a number of different reasons. We know that there's need for collecting and analyzing data on a wide range of sectors, and also for exploring how these different factors are interacting to shape COVID-19 risks and responses. So in a nutshell, what is intersectionality? Really, in a nutshell, it is theoretical positions as well as an analytical framework which seeks to revise the view that our social relations are expressed as separate roads. It helps us to better understand the multiple layers of advantage and disadvantage that structure our everyday lives. So three core tenets to intersectionality. Firstly, human beings are shaped by the interaction of different social locations. We don't lead a single issue lives, and hence our experiences are at the intersections of different aspects of identity and social location, race, ethnicity, indigeneity, gender, class, sexuality, geography, age, disability, ability, status, among others. The second tenet is that these interactions really are occurring within a context of connected systems and structures of power. It is the laws, the policies, the government institutions, the private institutions, among others, that are informing the ways in which the factors are shaped, in which these social locations are realized. And through these processes, it leads to interdependent forms of privilege and oppression, which is shaped by broader structures and processes of structural oppression, colonialism, imperialism, racism, homophobia, ableism, and patriarchy. And that is very clearly evident in the context of the ethnicity debate and issue that we are experiencing today in the UK and the excess burden generated by ethnicity of COVID infection and deaths. And I'll explain that shortly. So intersectionality is offering that platform on the three sort of core aspects that it adds to the analysis that we are undertaking on COVID today. Firstly, it refuses a predetermined hierarchy of vulnerable groups. It allows us to look at how vulnerabilities are getting shaped dynamically as a result of the transitions and transformations that I alluded to in my first slide. It also rejects a universal conception of experiences of vulnerable groups. So the idea that all women experience the impact of COVID in a similar way, or all men are equally at an increased susceptibility to the infection. What it allows us to look at is look at those risks and impacts that are shaped by a web of intersecting factors, including the ones that I had introduced earlier. And finally, I mean, the most important contribution of intersectionality is to locate the individual experience of the pandemic, of the risks and the burdens, with the institutional and the wider structural processes and systems of power, such as globalization, patriarchy, racism, among others. What I want to do in my next slide is just take a minute to exemplify this by a short case vignette on the health and social care workers within the NHS. We all know that the health and social care workers have been the backbone of the fight against the pandemic, and at the front line have been working in very overstretched and overburdened health systems, witnessing a huge shortage of the PPE, the protective gear, the training available to them, and as a result, working in extremely difficult circumstances. So while they're on one hand, they're witnessing gift vouchers and several schemes to applaud their contributions, at the same time, they've really put their lives at risk working in those extremely tense environments. We know that in more recent evidence that there is increased vulnerability of health and social care workers in working in the NHS to both infections and also dying from this as a result of greater exposure. We also know that the excess, that this is not equally distributed, and more recent evidence has emerged, has shown us there is an excess burden of infection, a greater need for intensive care, and also increased fatality rates among people from minority ethnic backgrounds. This was visible both in the community settings as well as in the NHS. And of course, diverse explanations have been put forward, ranging from biological and genetic, like the AC. The presence of ACP receptors, their higher susceptibility to the chronic conditions such as cardiovascular diseases and diabetes, but also increasingly the structural and upstream basis of the inequalities that the minority ethnic groups are witnessing. There's evidence. I mean, the evidence also suggests that the BAME is not a homogeneous group. There are differences in these exposures and experiences. In this editorial that I did with Kampui, we argued that the virus is not itself sentient or racist, but it is the social structures and responses to the crisis that reflect values and power structures that continue to discriminate and determine poorer outcomes for some more than others. Now, few studies and investigations have also put forward other explanations. There is structural racism. There's also overrepresentation of healthcare workers from ethnic minorities in lower paid roles within the NHS, which means that these roles cannot be done remotely. There've been most recent BMA survey of NHS workforce, which was conducted by a Royal College of Physicians, found that among the members, 48% were concerned about working in these high risk conditions, had reported anxiety and fears, but this was raised to 76% of among those from ethnic minority backgrounds. If we dig deeper, I mean, I'm chairing a consortium of academics who have, which is referred to as the ICOP consortium, which is applying an intersectionality lens to understand the experiences of health and social care workers and the experiences of protections within this and how the healthcare management workplace management policies have impacted them is revealing interesting results. I cannot share all the results because we're still in the analysis stage, but what the preliminary results have shown is that ethnicity is an important marker in these experiences, but it interacts with the migrant status, whether the health and social care workers were UK born or not, as well as the seniority and the professional role and cadre in which they function. What the study has found is a study of 500 health and social care workers who were surveyed found that the health and social care staff of ethnic minority origin were twice as likely to be in patient-facing role and working in COVID areas. And this increased four times when we adjusted for seniority. Also, non-UK-born migrants among these ethnic minority are, however, more likely to work in these COVID-affected areas and also worse off in terms of the emotional and mental health anxieties and burden that they're experiencing. That's just one example of what a multi-level and tiered analysis adopting an intersectionality lens can reveal. I'll just end with my final slide. There are frameworks available to do an intersectionality-based policy analysis, and what we really need to do is move beyond sex disaggregated data and siloed thinking approach, but embrace that intersectionality approach, but constantly revisit the dynamic and constitutive nature of these vulnerabilities and identifying who's worse off. I'll end with that and would welcome some question and answers. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Glasgow Centre for Population Health podcast. If you'd like to find out more, search podcasts at gcph.co.uk.